Venture time, shuffle up your deck. These new cards are just strong as heck. With a loose Avada and cheeky house mouse, we've got the brand new tech. It's adventure time.
All right, you good? You recording?
I'm ready.
Great, awesome, super duper. Off we pop then on a brand new episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy. I am here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony, Master Wizard of JavaScript Maddox.
Love to do some magical JavaScript. What did I do some magical JavaScript?
How uncomfortable does it make you every week that I say a thing that I've like planned and thought up, and then you, without knowing what it is, have to respond off the cuff?
Seven
out of ten uncomfortable?
We're going to leave the scale ambiguous.
Well, Anthony, your nickname this week... it's not all about you. Let me introduce our guests and maybe it'll make sense. We are joined this week on the episode by frequent guest, frequent contributor, Parker, apprentice wizard of JavaScript, Lamascus. Hi, Parker.
Hello. I do not like this language very much so far.
What? You did some JavaScript that was new to you. You said it was like new and you were very excited you got to pull it off.
I did. I'm very excited. I feel like I just sprang out of the 1999 classic The Matrix. And I have the sunglasses and everything, and it's good, but also it's not Python, and so it's uncomfortable.
I think this speaks volumes about your skill and competency here, that you've already correctly identified that JavaScript is a terrible programming language.
I just realized that Parker said, I don't like this language so far, and he was referring to JavaScript. I thought he meant what I was saying on the podcast. I thought he was offended I was calling him an apprentice JavaScript wizard. I'm like, Parker, you are new to JavaScript.
It could be both.
Yeah, JavaScript is it's a necessary evil that we all...
it's got a lot of complex history that we are just stuck with.
We all love to deal with, but congratulations on muddling through it and figuring something out, Parker. That's a great accomplishment.
Thank you very much.
You're doing a great personal growth.
Thanks. I do owe some credit to ChatGPT, so, you know...
Anthony's eyes are as big as dinner plates right now.
That's a whole other topic.
I think that's the one interesting way to use ChatGPT, to be fair.
Yeah, I told it, I would like you to translate this Python to JavaScript, and it did it pretty well.
Interesting.
This is the kind of thing it's actually really good at. There's a really good Tom Scott video that I'll put in the show notes about ChatGPT and AI. And, you know, Tom Scott is a computer programmer by trade, now he's a YouTube star, but he got into YouTube and, like, blogging and stuff because he's a programmer. And he was saying he had to write this tedious script to move a bunch of emails of his from one inbox to another between these two services that didn't have an import script, and he was like, this is gonna be really annoying and blah blah blah. And then he thought, I'll just try to have ChatGPT write it for me, and it just did it just like right away, and he was like shocked and amazed and thinks it's really both scary and exciting for the future of computer programming. I think that's the cool way to use it. So Parker, I applaud you. Anthony's
Thank
dinner
you.
Plate eyes be damned.
There's a lot we can say about ChatGPT and its intersection with programming. I think that my biggest feeling is that I'll mention is just like general anxiety about it. Like, sure, it wrote the script that did things, but ChatGPT is not a truth engine. It's just doing pattern matching. So,
and what are computer programmers doing, Anthony, if not looking up things on Stack Overflow and copying and pasting it until it works?
Great question.
But yeah, we all agree. We all agree on this call that ChatGPT, yeah, nor any AI, if you can even call it that, is a truth engine. But if you're just trying to write some dumb little script that you can then verify if it works or not, personally, manually, great. All for it. Also, I think it's awesome that if you go back like 10 years and you talk to like tech bros, their attitude was, well, you know, computer programming, that's the one thing that computers will never be able to do. It's like, it's because technology is getting bigger and more like advanced, we're going to be the most employable people for the rest of time. And of course, the job that is, by definition, the most structured work that is the most well-documented online and has the biggest repository of information to be trawled by various large language models, of course that's the easiest thing to replace. So,
they really just, like, got hoisted on their own petard there. They could have, you know, not constructed large language models to put themselves out of business, but they did.
I love a tech bro being hoisted on a petard. That's my dream. I love to see that. Mm.
Unrelated question, Parker. Did you not use the script that I had already written that's in the repository?
I edited it.
Okay, you edited it.
Generalized it, yeah.
Oh.
Did you not see Parker's message in the Discord?
I used a Matrix screenshot and everything. It was a very high-effort message.
I did see that.
Okay, that makes me feel better.
Anyway, great job, team. I love this for us. Good job, Parker, for one of the only valid, reasonable uses of quote-unquote AI. But we can't talk about this anymore because we got magic cards to talk about, boys. This is our job. This is very important work that the people demand of us. This is our Wilds of Eldraine cube set review part two, where we're talking about the results from the community survey that we've been running for the past couple weeks. We are recording this before we are done collecting data, so note that we're going to list testing percentages and, you know, scores and stuff in this episode. Those might differ slightly from the actual values that are in the article when you hear this, because Anthony and I are doing some traveling, so we're recording this a little earlier than normal. But we're excited to talk about all the cards that all the cube designers out there are most interested in playing from their respective cubes. Parker, you want to give us a quick rundown of how this old survey works?
I would love to. So for every new premiere set, or actually just every new set in Magic, we publish a survey and we ask cube owners and cube curators to tell us what cards they're testing from the new set. And we also ask them to self-rate those cards on a scale of 1 to 10. Now, this is based on whatever criteria that cube designer has in mind, whether that's power level. Often it's power level, but not always. Sometimes it's flavor match to the, you know, funky thematic format that they've got going on. Or sometimes it's just the right power level, and they might dock a card points if it seems too powerful. Or maybe they just like the art. It's really whatever that designer likes about a card, they can rate them. And then we compile those results and put it into a prospective set review that is really intended to capture the cube community's opinions and thoughts about a set before it releases widely.
Yeah, this is kind of our way to do a more comprehensive set review. There's a lot of writers out there that will make their various cube set reviews where they look at the list of new cards themselves and they decide what cards they think are most relevant to the most cubes. And rather than try and speculate, we just like to ask you directly. And so that's what this survey is. And I gotta say, I am just, every time we get a new set and a new survey results in, I am just further and further hardened to feel like power level is less and less becoming a factor in the results here. Like, it truly felt when we started these surveys, what, almost 4 years ago? Because we started with original Eldraine. This is like...
Yeah, that's a great point. This is kind of a milestone.
Yeah. It really felt like in the original days of the survey that it was largely a, okay, if you're playing a power maxed, legacy-ish, or vintage cube, what are the cards that are most powerful in this set and most relevant for your own cube? Over time, I think the consensus has broadened. There's no longer like a few cards people are most excited about, and it's just more kind of spread out, the excitement about cards. And also, looking at this list, I mean, small spoiler, I don't think this is anywhere near a list of the most powerful cards in this set at all. So I think it's pretty exciting that we just keep on seeing more beautiful diversity in the cube design world. And for those of you out there that are designing your own cubes, I think this is a great way to just have the cards in the set sorted by some human way, right? Like, if you're just trying to have some help in digesting a whole new card file, which can be very intimidating, this is a, like, you know, rough order you can start looking at things to try and find cards that might fit for your own cube, because statistically these fit in the most people's cubes.
I think that also makes this resource more useful, because so many other resources are geared towards finding the most powerful cards, because that's what's relevant to you if you're playing standard or you're playing modern. But cube is just, you know, this one space where we can evaluate cards by so many different metrics, and this just being not just redundant to those other types of reviews just makes it potentially more interesting to me.
Parker, should we start with this this lovely breakdown, this mechanic graph here?
Yeah, so I guess before we get there, I just want to mention that we've had almost 250 people submit cubes to this survey. So we're really grateful to all of that participation from the community. And it's also quite respectable. I mean, Lord of the Rings had slightly fewer respondents, I think, because in part Reddit was shut down for a strike. But then this is a lot of respondents, and people are testing a lot of cards from this set, a median of 10, which... it's a large number compared to many sets. So I think we're in for a treat here with Wilds of Eldraine as a set for cube.
I think there's a lot of great cards here for a lot of cubes of different design considerations and power levels.
Yeah. So I guess now it's time to get to the mechanics graph. So this is something that we kind of tested with Phyrexia All Will Be One, and it went pretty well. And then we did some JavaScript, and yes, here it is again, making its wondrous return. So this is effectively, if you're familiar with a histogram or a probability density chart from your statistics past lives, then that's what this is. But if you're not familiar, don't worry. This is a way of representing how many people are testing cards with new mechanics and how deep that mechanic goes, is kind of how I'd try and put it as simply as possible.
Real quick meta comment here. Adventure is not new, nor is food. Should this be labeled something else? Like, what is the actual... This is just like the flagship mechanics of the set, right?
Yes, flagship mechanics is a better way to put it. So I was kind of trying to think of an analogy here. And, okay, so this is going to reveal my music taste, but like, if you think about fans of the band Tool, right? If you're in the car with somebody and a Tool song comes up on their, you know, shuffle, chances are they have four or five albums worth of Tool songs in their library, right? Whereas with a band that's less popular, I don't know, this is why this is a bad analogy.
No.
Name a band.
Any band.
You know, the Devin Townsend Project or something, a much less popular artist, and a single comes on from that, it might just be the one-hit wonder. You know, it doesn't necessarily represent a high chance that their library is totally full of Devin Townsend Project songs. And I'm sorry for everybody who didn't understand those bands. I listen to weird music.
So wait, just to clarify, Tool is your example of a very popular band.
Yeah, Tool's the normal example here, not like Beyonce or
Taylor Swift.
I literally cannot name a Beyonce song off the top of my head.
Wow.
I'm thinking, and there's one about the one I love, and there's Put a Ring on It.
Okay.
I know. I need to stop talking. I'm just digging this hole deeper.
Point being, if
people like a Tool song, they will like them all, right? Is the idea. Hello, Parker here with temporary time-traveling superpowers granted by Andy to record a better analogy for this mechanics graph. So those popular mechanics like Adventure, the ones where people are testing a whole bunch of Adventure cards, that's like a movie made and directed by George Lucas. Chances are most Americans will have seen at least one Star Wars, and if you've seen one Star Wars, you've probably seen a bunch of them. The other mechanics that are less popular, like Rolls or Bargain, that have fewer people testing whole bunches of the mechanics, that's more like a movie made and directed by Jane Campion. You may have seen The Power of the Dog because it won a couple of Oscars a couple years ago, but the average audience member is less likely to be following every movie she produces and directs. So that's kind of how to think about the popular mechanics versus the less popular ones. All right. This feels powerful. I'm going to do this more often. This is maybe what you've described on the show before as a long tail. I don't know if that makes sense at all.
Yeah, both Anthony and I are making a face like, is that what we mean when we say long tail? And hard to say. Really, what this graph is showing is, I think it's a great way to visualize very quickly the relative popularity of these mechanics, right? Because if you're looking at a list of the most tested cards, you know, like, I mean, we'll do a couple little spoilers here, but one of the cards that's being tested by quite a few people is Embereth Veteran, right? And so you look at that, and you think, well, here's a card that's being tested by a lot of people. Does that mean Rolls are popular? It's much harder to like look through the entire list very carefully and actually like start to tally things up. And so that's what this graph basically does, is it shows you that, you know, well, you can see here visually, and this is an audio medium, so you should go check out the article to see this for yourself, but pretty clearly Adventure is the standout hit mechanic of the set. It goes so much deeper than all the other mechanics people are testing.
It has the longest tail.
Yes, it's just like spread throughout in a way that really demonstrates its popularity above and beyond just what are the 10 most popular cards and what are those mechanics represented on them.
Right, so when we talk about the results later and we say, oh, this adventure card is really highly popular among our respondents, it's not just that one card. People are willing to test 10, 11, 12, 17, 22 adventure cards. Actually, multiple people submitted 22 adventure cards in their surveys. So this is a beloved mechanic, I think.
How many cards with adventure are even in the set? It looks like...
Looks like there are 51 cards with adventure. So that is kind of funny to have multiple people with exactly that number.
Yeah, but like people are willing to test almost half the cards in the set with adventure on them. Whereas, like Andy mentioned, with roll, this is more like the one-hit wonder, where people are testing a roll card or a couple roll cards, up to, I think, maybe five roll cards, but not every roll card in the set, not half of the roll cards in the set. So people are like less willing to go deep on this. Now, that might mean that roll is complicated or people don't want to introduce this new mechanic. But for other mechanics like bargain or celebration, which have often the reminder text or like it just spells out what the mechanic does in the case of celebration, I think it's not necessarily a bad thing to be a one-hit wonder in terms of cube popularity. It might just mean that the mechanic is so inoffensive and so vanilla that people aren't really even evaluating it as a mechanic. They're just saying, oh, this is another piece of rules text, and if I like the rules text, I'll add it.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many cube designers are really looking from a like mechanical lens in the sense of saying, I either like or dislike this mechanic for my cube. I think the vast majority of cube designers are looking on like a card-by-card basis. And so...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would push back on that just because reading through a lot of the comments, because a lot of people that submit the survey also just, you know, give us their general thoughts, which you can go and look at those answers as well, in addition to looking at sort of the compiled results. And there's a big trend of people that are saying specifically, adventure is a great mechanic, I want to try a bunch of adventures. And a lot of people specifically saying, I'm not interested in rolls because they don't have complete reminder text or there's potential for confusion. So a lot of people are thinking about it in this way.
Well, I mean, we say that, and yet one of the most popular cards in the set is Ember the Veteran. So.
Right, which surprised me a little bit after reading through those comments.
Yeah, I think it's the phenomenon where you can talk about averages, and that may not describe an individual very well at all. Like, you know, you can say the average American man is, you know, 5'9 or whatever.
Endless but... is a tool.
Endless is a tool.
You're really cheating yourself up some really difficult analogies this recording.
I'm so
marker.
Terrible. Yeah, I'm
no, you're
sorry.
Great. You're doing a great job. For my part, I think that for all of these mechanics, there is this like cost-benefit analysis. And I'm not playing any roll cards, partially because I do think they introduce some additional rules complexity that's just not worth it. But it's not worth it in the context of the cards with roll that are printed that I would otherwise be interested in for my cube. I'm not ruling the mechanic out completely. If they had printed a card that I love that happened to involve rolls, I probably would be willing to play it one or two cards with this mechanic and bite the bullet on that complexity for the benefit of playing a card I really love. In this case, though, I'm not in love with any of the roll cards, so it's easy enough for me to just kind of ignore that particular mechanic overall. So I think a lot of people are in that boat where it's not like where people couldn't make a objective decision about an entire mechanic absent the card file. Like if you just said, here are the mechanics, tell me before you look at the cards if you're going to play any of these, I think a lot of people would say, I don't know, even if they don't like a mechanic, you know, on its face or, you know, it's not their favorite implementation of a particular theme.
I look at this graph and I do kind of compare it instinctively to the Phyrexia All Will Be One mechanics graph that we did. And that set had Toxic as a mechanic, which introduced poison counters, which I think it was Bloated Contaminator had Toxic 1, but it was a 3-3 trample for 4. Maybe it was Toxic 2.
I think it was 4-4 trample for 3.
That's right, yeah.
Switch those numbers around to make it even more messed up.
Yeah, wow. And people were really, I think, testing Bloated Contaminator in spite of the Toxic in some cases. So it was not as if the new mechanic was incidental or you know, vestigial on this design. It was actively a drawback for people considering Bloated Contaminator, but the rate was so much that you did it anyways. Roll, I'm not sure, is in that boat. It might just be that people like the design of a few roll cards, and so they're playing the ones they like, and the fact that it makes a roll is maybe tangential or less important to their evaluation of the card overall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We could probably talk about this graph for several more minutes, but I think just to summarize, it's worth a deep dive. You can actually click on each bin in the graph, and you can see which cards got people interested. So when people are testing 22 adventures, what are the ones that, you know, piqued their interest? So it's interactive, and I will appreciate if people go on this and then compliment me on my JavaScript. And
everybody,
Anthony as well.
Send JavaScript. Everybody send Parker a compliment for muddling through a clunky, inelegant language. Do you have any other observations about the overall trends in the survey responses, Parker or Anthony?
I can try and summarize it as succinctly as possible with no awkward analogies. Adventure is extremely popular among our respondents. Food follows close behind, and then rolls and bargain are kind of less popular, but celebration is the least popular of all in terms of testing bunches and bunches of these cards at once.
Yeah, adventure continues to be a big fan favorite mechanic. It's a mechanic I really like too, and I can't even really articulate exactly why. You know, it's obviously a type of modal card, but I think there's something to the type of modal card where you either obviously can have one thing, which is just casting the creature side, ignoring the adventure entirely. Like, that's like one approach to treating these cards as modal. Or the other mode is you like essentially kind of have kicker, but spread across multiple turns, right? You get more for more mana, but you get to spread it out across multiple turns. And the inherent like card advantage that's intrinsic in so many of the adventures, because a lot of them are board affecting in some way, and they also draw you a card. The card they draw, of course, being the thing you can cast from exile, from the adventure zone. I don't know what it is about this mechanic, but it just works for me. I'm not going to lie. For me, a big part of it is I love the frame, the original Eldraine showcase frame, which is brought back here. That's a big factor. The designs just seem cool. Like the adventure cards feel so much cooler to me than other mechanics, right? Like, I have absolutely nothing against bargain or celebration. I think those mechanics are really clean and nicely designed, but none of the cards have that cool factor for me, which gets me excited and wanting to see if they can work in my environment.
Another powerful thing about it is that because these are all sort of essentially effectively modal cards, it allows you to get a lot of effects that you otherwise might not get players to play. So you maybe get combat tricks or other minor things that just wouldn't make sense as a whole card on their own.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about the adventure cards that I currently run is just having a spell for decks that care about casting instant sorceries and a creature when you don't care about that. It's just such a clean way to like, yeah, I'll put a Fairy Guide Mother in my deck with Monastery Mentor because it's also just a spell. You know, it just does the thing you want to do whenever you draw it, which is nice.
It's cool that it's a transparent card advantage mechanic. Like, obviously, these are all two for ones, you know, plus or minus. But you also have to do a little bit of work, and so it sparks that like deck building instinct where it's like, oh, how can I synergize with the spell half and the creature half or whatever? Yeah, it's even more appealing somehow than if they just put draw a card on creatures that didn't have adventures. You know what I mean? Like, they're making us work for it a little bit, and that almost makes it more appealing in the case of adventure.
My hot take for Wilds of Eldraine is that this set is one that builds an amazing foundation for new cubes, especially the open-endedness bargain, which allows you to focus on enchantments and or artifacts and or tokens, means that you can build an environment around it in several ways. I like that overlaps with mechanics such as Delirium, really encouraging you to use enchantment and artifact, the two lesser used card types. And if you were to go in an artifact direction, the mechanic offers some tension with other mechanics such as Metalcraft or Affinity. I think my big takeaway here is that the set uses tokens very well, but for existing cubes, it's mostly being held back by just the baggage of Magic being a game that has been around for a while. All the tokens that exist already cause a lot of clutter, and it's going to be pretty nasty to deal with all these new tokens, which all have minor variations. Speaking of, I think the rat tokens show a trend that should continue, in my opinion. They should make way more tokens, be unable to block, because I think it just encourages the games to go in a much faster pace.
I desperately want to start with the Goose Mother, which is a card I just want to talk about. This is the 13th most popular card being tested from Wilds of Eldraine, with, at time of recording, 21.1% of our respondents testing it, and an overall rating of 6.9. I guess we didn't describe the rating system. We ask everyone to score the cards on a scale from 1 to 10, and that is a purely subjective how much you like this card for your cube score. So entirely up to each individual cube design consideration or cube need, nothing sort of universal that you can apply across the board to everybody. But overall, it ends up being a pretty nice average of just like how confident people are they're going to want to continue cubing with this card in 3, 6, 12 months or whatever. So the Goose Mother is a X green blue for a legendary creature bird Hydra. It's got really cool art. It is a goose with many heads. I think it's awesome. It's a flying 2/2 that enters the battlefield with X +1/+1 counters on it. And also when it enters the battlefield, it makes half X food tokens rounded up. And whenever it attacks, you may sacrifice the food. If you do, draw a card. This is, I think, a kind of classic green-blue card in that it is a X spell, which we see a lot in green-blue. It gains life and draws cards, which we also see a lot in green-blue. I think it is rightfully drawing comparisons to Hydroid Krasis and perhaps less rightfully drawing comparisons to Uro. It's just another kind of value-generating card that you can kind of run in that slot. A couple people have pointed out, and I want to sort of call out here, that I think one of the things that is really tricky with designing X spells is how on rate they are at different parts of the curve. And the nature of a lot of X spells is that they tend to be kind of below rate or well below rate at lower values of X. And then there's like a sweet spot where they may be on rate. And then when you get up to high mana values, you're really getting paid off for obviously dumping a bunch of mana into it. I've seen in a couple of other set reviews and agree totally that I think the most common way you're going to cast the Goose Mother is as a 3-drop. And it's a 3-drop that's a 3/3 flyer that makes a food, and if you get to untap with it and swing, it also draws a card. Or obviously you can gain a life with that food if you want. If you have other ways to make food in your deck, you can potentially draw more cards. But, you know, effectively a cantripping 3/3 flyer for 3, with the caveat that you have to untap with it, is quite pushed. I mean, it's a really good value-generating creature. I selfishly wanted this card to be a better fit for the Bun Magic Cube because I was really just enamored with the idea of a Goose Hydra. But it's not quite right for that environment, I don't think. But I think there's a lot of cubes for which this will be a really sweet sort of spot for maybe people that don't want to play with Uro because it's extremely powerful and can be very warping, but still want something in that kind of range that, you know, Hydra Krasis is a great example of a card that you're really not happy until you're casting it for, I believe, 5. I haven't looked at the card's rule text in a while. It's been a while since I cubed it, but I think you really want to be paying 5 mana for it before you're happy or, you know, at least content with your return on your investment. Here, you're very happy to play this on 3, I think.
Yeah, but also happy on 4, 5, 6.
Oh, yeah.
Especially as, you know, if this is a top deck late game, oh, man, that's exactly, you know, the kind of card that you'd want to see on the top.
Though I do think it's worse if you're dumping a bunch of mana into it than Hydroid Krasis, which draws you the cards immediately. Like, this can still just die to removal and not draw you any cards no matter how much mana you dump into it, which I think does make it, like, if you were to, I just can picture in my head, like, a graph of relative value at different points in the curve. And I think the Goose is better lower and Hydro Crisis is better higher. There's somewhere in the middle where they cross. And so it's a question of, like, if you want this kind of card, now you have this great variety of which point of the curve do you want this to be most impactful.
And I do think there's something to the fact that Goose Mother is good early. Sometimes my least favorite thing about Hydro Crisis when I played it in Standard was that you just, like, wait and wait and then you cast it for an arbitrary amount of mana, and because it's a cast trigger, it doesn't matter whether your opponent counters the spell, and it's just like so safe almost. And that's maybe not something I want to be providing the player who's on like turn 12. I want them to still feel a little bit of risk when they're tapping out for a big thing, I guess.
Right above the Goose Mother, we have Fairy Dream Thief. This is 1 black mana for a creature, Fairy Warlock. It's got flying. When it enters the battlefield, surveil 1. It also has 3 mana, exile Fairy Dream Thief from your graveyard, draw a card, and lose 1 life. Being tested by 21.5% of respondents so far, with an average rating of 6. Not a super great rating, but a reasonable chunk of people that are interested in it. This seems just like a really simple, straightforward card. It's a reasonable small creature that then also recoups that value in the late game as well. So I'm guessing at Uncommon this is being tested a lot in Peasant and Pauper cubes.
I'm actually playing this in my Pulp Nouveau cube.
Yeah.
Mostly because this will start a little bit of a self-mill thing if that's what your deck is interested in, but also it has this sideways value where it's kind of good when it's milled over.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, better than kind of. I mean, compared to a card that doesn't do anything in the graveyard, it's way, 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 way better.
Yeah, so I'm happy to play this on turn one and mill Faithless Looting. I'm also happy to cast Faithless Looting on one and discard this. I like that it plays on both those axes. It could be fair and just a slow two for one, or it could be a little bit unfair. But there's like, it's not going to be that busted because
yeah,
there's
three mana.
I don't
know if it's ever unfair. I mean, it's like, it's value to mill right. over, but, you know, it's yeah. think twice value if you mill it over, which is not, you know, not right. blowing anybody's socks off. I'm low-key kind of high on this card. I think it's a really slick little design. I'm going to call it and say that I think it's very similar to me to, like, Thraben Inspector, in that it's this little trinket creature that has the potential to replace itself and also has interactions with a couple of other, like, has a couple of touch points where it touches other archetypes, right? Like, people like Thraben Inspector because it also gives you an artifact and it also cares about sacrificing stuff. This similarly cares about self-milling or, you know, lets you surveil, which is a little bit of card selection. I think cards are really slick. I'm really into it. It's not right for any of my cubes, I don't think, but I'm glad to see it relatively high on this list. And I think even more people could potentially take a look at it as a card that fills that kind of Thraben Inspector or Hard Evidence, like, curve filler for decks that they want to have some kind of theme to, right? Like, I guess you could compare this to, like, just a regular cantrip or something, right? And if you have self-mill and you have, you know, reasons to want to interact with the graveyard in more novel ways, then this could be a way for you to get a, like, otherwise just grease the wheels of your deck, like, keep things moving forward kind of card into your cube that touches those themes.
Yeah, that's a great point. I actually would maybe compare it to Fairy Seer, which is, similarly, it's just a creature that doesn't look super impactful as just a 1-mana 1-1 flyer, ETB, scry 2, but it gets played in a lot of cubes, especially that support ninja themes and things like that, where you both want cheap flyers or cheap evasive creatures, and then get extra value out of multiple Enter the Battlefield triggers. So this being the same thing in black, shifted a scry 2 for a surveil 1, kind of seems
and
fine.
Draw a card. I mean, and like, also, I think this is substantially better than Fairy Seer. I mean, the fact that Fairy Seer is in blue, I think, is one of its
right.
one of the notable things about it, but just mechanics alone, I think this is a more powerful card than Fairy Seer is in most contexts. So, yeah, I think the card's really sick. I'm into it.
Our next card is Decadent Dragon. This is 2 red-red for a creature dragon. It's a 4/4 flying trample, and whenever it attacks, create a treasure token. Now, it's also got an adventure. Expensive Taste is 2 and a black, an instant adventure. Exile the top 2 cards of target opponent's library face down. You may look at and play those cards for as long as they remain exiled. Notably, it does not fix the colors of, like, it doesn't say you can pay mana of any color. So you actually either need to be able to cast it, or you need to create a treasure token when you attack with your dragon, or you need to get lucky and exile one of their lands because you can play your opponent's lands. This is tested by 22% of our respondents with an average rating of 6.1. I personally don't love this, and I think it's only because I do run some cards that let you play off your opponent's library, and then they fix the colors for that. And so there's a little bit of a tension here where it's like, I can expect people misreading this or misplaying it because they're expecting a different template than what's actually on the card. That said, I do really like the design of this, and I don't fault anybody who does choose to run it.
Yeah, I think the two things you called out are the two things that are notable here. The not fixing for mana, so you actually have to pay the costs, and also the fact that you can play lands. A lot of the cards that you play cards off your opponent's deck do not let you play lands. They only let you cast spells. So that, I think, is a very notable difference. I will say, too, for cube context, make sure to give your opponent's lands back, because there's a lot of ways in which you might steal your opponent's cards, but it's very rare that you can steal a card that is actually in your deck. But if you hit a basic land that you're also playing one of or something, it'll be very confusing, potentially. Make sure that you actually, you know, keep track of that if you're playing this in your cube. But yeah, I think it's cool. I don't know. I agree that there's room for that kind of misinterpretation. I think if that wasn't a danger, I actually really like the tension of that, where you don't just get to cast my cards without working for it. You probably have to stick a 4-mana 4/4 and, you know, get to swing with it once or twice before you can actually cast all the spells off my library. I think it's kind of cool. All right, the 10th most popular card from Wilds of Eldraine for most cubes is Restless Cottage. This is the creature land that is the second highest on the survey. We'll get to number one a little bit later. This is the black-green one, so it taps for black or green, enters the battlefield tapped, and you can turn it into a creature for two black-green, and it becomes a 4/4 black and green horror creature token until end of turn. That's still a land. And whenever it attacks, you create a food token and exile up to one target card from a graveyard. Parker, I think Anthony and I both, I mean, Restless Vinestalk aside for me, but I think otherwise, Anthony and I kind of both feel like the individual like mechanics of these like creature lands is not the most relevant thing. It's like if you want different kind of creature lands that differ from the ones we've gotten in various Zendikar sets in the past, this is a great opportunity to play those. Do you have a more like nuanced take on like what these actually do mechanically? I mean, this one reminds me of Hive of the Eye Tyrant. That's the mono black Adventures in the Forgotten Realms creature land that exiles creatures when it attacks. I think it has menace and, you know, it doesn't make food tokens, obviously. Do you think people are playing this highly because they explicitly really want the 4/4 that exiles stuff from the graveyard and makes food tokens? Or do you think it's just that this is now the more appealing of the black-green creature land options for people that wanted a black-green creature land? And it's really, like, how much do you think the mechanics on these specific creature lands is a factor of where they are on this list versus just how they compare relatively to previous options that we've had?
It's probably a little bit of both, but I would lean towards this just being an appealing mana-fixing land. Like, even the fact that it's a creature land may be less important than the fact that it's a dual land. With Hive of the Eye Tyrant, you know, I'm often not activating that if I have other things to do with my mana. But if my opponent played Uro last turn, then suddenly that's a new tactic that's in consideration for me. I might want to attack with my creature land, maybe clear a blocker or something, and get rid of the Uro before it can come back.
I love that play pattern of that card specifically. I find that it comes up a lot where it's like, normally your play pattern, your like heuristic for creature lands is like, okay, this is a mana sink if I get flooded or, you know, don't have anything else to do with my mana. But I think that exact kind of situation you described is really cool about Hive of the Eye Tyrant because it gives you a really good reason to activate when otherwise you do have spells to cast. But if there's something really important for you to get rid of from the graveyard, then it gives you this other option, which I think is really compelling.
Yeah, and you know, Hive comes in untapped during the first, I think, two turns of the game. And that's one way of like getting it over the line and making it worth the opportunity cost and making it worth the occasional times when it comes into play tapped and is inconvenient. Restless Cottage, on the other hand, kind of gets over because it taps for two different colors. And that's just something that a lot of decks are going to be interested in. So I think this is just a fixing land with additional upside is pretty bread and butter. And so I don't think the mechanics actually matter that much. It does matter that this is like, it's not nothing. A 4/4 that costs 4 mana to activate, that's, you know, significant. And I'd argue is also like better game design than a 2/2 Death Touch, which is what Hissing Quagmire is.
Hissing Quagmire is a real bummer.
Like, it's just going to chump block all day and it's just terrible.
And that's kind of what I'm speculating here is that I think part of the popularity of this one in particular over one of the other dual lands is how much of a bummer Hissing Quagmire is. I feel like there's probably a lot of cube designers out there that like to run complete cycles or they like having, you know, similar effects available to all the different color combinations and maybe we're running Hissing Quagmire out of some sense of obligation and now have a much more exciting option. This is a much more interesting, dynamic, interactive card than Quagmire was. So
yeah,
definitely do it for that reason.
And it's worth saying that some people seem to be running complete cycles of the Restless lands. This is the first one we've mentioned, but Restless, Bivouac, Spire, and I think Fortress are all further down the list at around the same amount of testing. So the whole cycle is seems quite appealing, even if we're only talking about this one for now.
Yeah, I think it's probably the most broadly appealing cycle in the set. I mean, the Virtue cycle has some more appealing individual options, but also some that basically nobody are touching. Whereas, yeah, I think all five of these are fairly popular. And it's also worth saying, too, that I just think all of these are half a notch better on rate and more powerful. There's definitely some power creep at play here comparing these two previous creature lands. So if you're just looking for slightly more powerful cards that fill a similar role, that's another reason to pursue the Restless Lands over, you know, Lumbering Falls et al.
These are also all some of the most highly rated cards. So not necessarily just how many people are testing them, but how highly they've been rated. Restless Cottage is at 7.4, and it's number 4 in the list so far. So, you know, there are a couple of things that are up to 7.6. So, I mean, that's also an interesting thing here as well, is that the average ratings don't go super high. We don't have any, like, obvious slam dunks in, like, the 8 or 9 range. So, yeah, these are all, the people that are interested in them are pretty confident in them.
Speaking of not having a slam dunks, Anthony, here's for their next card.
Our next card is Embrith Veteran. This is red for a 2-1 creature, a human knight. It has one generic mana, sacrifice Embrith Veteran, create a young hero role attached to another target creature. And a young hero role, of course, as you'll recall, is a token aura that you attach to one of your creatures. And whenever that creature attacks, if it has toughness 3 or less, put a 1-1 counter on it. So slowly grow your creature. I think that this is interesting to me in that it is the, if we're going top to bottom, this is the only card that makes a roll that we're seeing on this list this high. And it's just like an extremely familiar type of card, this sort of like Jackalpup type card, but has a pretty major upside that you get to cash it in for this bonus to make one of your other creatures bigger at some point. So it makes sense to me that of the cards that make rolls, this is the one that people are willing to sort of bite that extra complexity for.
I'm looking at cards like this when I'm saying that I'm really excited to see that I feel like the overall approach to cube design has broadened. The Jackalpup with no downside, with a, in most cubes, much better type line and like reasonable upside. This is a card that I think if you went back just 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, would be tested by like 80% of the people that were designing cubes, basically. I don't know, maybe this is just like the side effect of getting so many new sets and so many power crept cards that, like, I think partially the cube design world has evolved and people are exploring more novel space and holding their cards to a higher standard of like gameplay patterns. But I also think it's just like we never needed a cube community or a survey to like help us identify what the best aggressive red one drops were, right? Like that is a fairly known quantity. So the fact that like this card is only at 24% of our respondents testing it is, I think, notable for what it says about the overall trends in the cube design world. As far as the card itself goes, I actually think this is a really nice design. I was close to playing this one. This is the one roll card that got me close to doing it. It is, you know, the kind of typical trope, which is we usually find in white, but now we're getting in red, which is a, you know, 1 mana, 2/1 with upside, right? I think the nature of the upside here is really relevant because it is very often going to be relevant in a situation where your 1 mana, 2/1 is no longer relevant, which is to say that, you know, you're very happy to have your 1 mana, 2/1 on the first turn or two of the game where your opponent is unlikely to have blockers or you have a couple removal spells to clear blockers and you can just get in and make your one card be worth 4, 6, or 8 points of damage. As soon as they have a couple blockers, though, these cards just become kind of dead cards, right? Or they demand that you have some other use for them, like crewing vehicles or something. In those situations, I think very often the addition of a young hero role to one of your other threats is going to turn a board where you couldn't get in with anything into a board where you're one creature fewer, but you actually have something that can attack now, which I think is a nice design. So I like the design of this card. I think it's pretty elegant if this is the kind of thing you're looking for.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you could even think of it a little bit less like an early game creature with late game upside, but also just a modal spell, and you could just pay 2 mana to put a roll token onto one of your creatures. So,
yep.
Yeah.
I really also like the story that's being told here. You know, the veteran is like fought their last battle, and so they're hanging up their armor and they're passing on their, you know, role to, no pun intended, their role as a fighter to a young hero, and that young hero will then take up the sword and continue the fight.
Yeah, it's resonant.
Really neat story there. Now, jumping off Anthony's points about this being the most popular single role card, if we jump back to the mechanics graph very briefly, I just want to mention that nearly half of our respondents are testing at least one role maker. Often that's going to be the Embrith Veteran because it was the most popular, but it's not always.
Yeah, it's only 24%. So if half our respondents are testing at least one role card, at the most, only half of them could be testing Embrith Veteran.
Yeah, that's right. But a fifth of our respondents are testing more than one role card. All this to say, a fifth of our respondents see enough value in roles or like find enough good gameplay there that they're testing more than one of these cards, not just the Embrith Veteran, right? So it's not purely a matter of power level. Some people are also maybe interested because of role, not just because of the 2-1. All right, I think our next card is...
Number 8,
Restless Vinestalk. This is a land that enters the battlefield tapped. It adds green or blue. And for 3 green and a blue, it becomes, until end of turn, a 5/5 green and blue plant creature with trample. It's still a land. And whenever it attacks, up to 1 other target creature has base power and toughness, 3/3, until end of turn. Nearly a quarter of our respondents are testing this card with an average ranking of 7.2. I'm actually not playing this one. I don't feel the need to run complete cycles, and this is the one I liked the least because it's very expensive to activate.
Pop off, King. Let's talk more about that. This is the one I like the most. It's the most popular one in the survey. So what is it? Is it just purely the expense to activate that makes you not into this one?
Yeah, I mean, I actually like the design fairly well. It's just, I don't know. I'm not going to pay 5 mana for this. Or maybe I should
I ain't reading all that. Good for you. Exactly. Or I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah. Maybe I should say I don't want to make my drafters do this with 5 mana.
It is higher risk, right? I mean, this does have no value in the face of removal. If you just activate this and they have a Doomblade or whatever, then you just dumped a bunch of mana into nothing. I like the more expensive activations. I think my favorite dual creature land prior to Wilds of Eldraine was definitely Celestial Colonnade, which is also fairly expensive to activate. I like that play pattern because very often you want to be activating your creature lands when you're flooded anyway, and so having a more powerful effect at that point in the game rather than only being able to, you know, turn your land into a relatively small creature for less mana, I found to be a desirable play pattern. I think it also kind of helps a little bit with the potential decision paralysis that can come on like middle turns of the game where you have to decide, do I want to like activate an attack or instead advance my board state more? I know I felt that sometimes with specifically Raging Ravine. It's a card that you can turn into a creature for 4 mana, so it's cheaper. And importantly, it like grows with every attack. And so oftentimes I feel like if I'm pressuring my opponent, I have to answer this question of like, do I want to activate the Raging Ravine to start growing it and to keep pressure on, or would I rather be playing to the board and getting cards out of my hand? And if that's a decision you like, then obviously you prefer the cheaper ones. But I kind of like that it makes it a little simpler to say, like, all right, this is just a dual land until I get to the point in the game where this matters, and I can kind of put that out of my head until I've got an abundance of mana to actually think about. And your opponent can do the same when it comes to like whether they can attack into your board. Having to remember you can activate your Stirring Wildwood for only 3 mana means that they have to think about that a lot more and for a lot larger portion of the game than whether you can activate your Restless Vinestalk or whatever.
I do think that you're right as well that Lumbering Falls was one of the less loved of these creature lands from previous cycles, so it does kind of not surprise me to see this one at the top of that cycle.
Hey everybody, I do want to add one note about the Restless Lands that we neglected to mention in the episode that I actually even neglected to notice myself, which is that the abilities attached to these lands actually apply regardless of how the land became a creature. So the power and toughness obviously is linked to you activating the ability on the land, but in the case of Vinestalk, the making another creature base power and toughness 3/3, or in the case of Cottage, making food and exiling things from graveyards, that just happens if that creature's animated in any way. So if you have your Nissa who shakes the world and you uptick on one of these lands, then you still get that ability as gravy attached to it. So shout out to Thistle in the MTG Cube Talk Discord for bringing this to at least my attention. And one little note about these Restless Lands, if you're cubing them, keep your eyes peeled for that. All right, we've talked a lot about Restless Vinestalk on our previous episode too, which is where Anthony and I talked about our own personal cube inclusions. So if you want more Vinestalk talk, check out that episode, which will be linked in the show notes. But next up, the 7th most popular card for Wilds of Eldraine is Regal Bunnicorn. 1 and a white for a star-star rabbit unicorn whose power and toughness is equal to the number of non-land permanents you control. Childhood Andy.
That's a lot of things, maybe.
Childhood Andy is looking at his copy of 7th edition Beast of Burden, and he is in shambles. Beast of Burden... totally trash these days when you can take 2 mana.
Doesn't Beast of Burden count all creatures,
your
opponents?
It does, but it's not strictly worse, but I think we can argue that it's pretty clearly much, 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 much worse than Regal Bunnicorn for 2 mana.
All right, this might be a hot take, because I know this is also the cutest card in the set, but Beast of Burden, I think I might like the illustration of more.
Yeah, it's really cool. This card is a perfect opportunity for us to call back to one of what has now become one of the tropes of the show. It was so much easier for me to evaluate this card because of the big and small game language that Sam Black has given us through the vessel of Parker. This has a potentially really high ceiling. I think we see a lot of people talking about, like, this could be a 2-mana 5-5 or a 2-mana 6-6. Like,
think what of other it, numbers do you know that
think,
are more than...
Name another number. Think of it with treasures or with food tokens or whatever, or clues. And it's very easy to, like, see this potential upside. And at least for the Bun Magic Cube, which is the only cube I can answer this for, it's a very small game cube, and I think this card would be awful in the Bun Magic Cube. I have people ask me if I'm testing it, and no, I think it would be really, really, really bad. If it was a problem, it could probably pretty easily be answered, or you were already way ahead anyway, or if it's a board state that's that big with stuff, either you're way ahead or you're in some kind of stall, and then is a vanilla creature really getting you out of a stall? I don't know. I think this would have been a harder card for me to evaluate if I did not have all of that language that we have around big and small games to understand the context of my environment and where this card would be good or bad.
I'm just glad that you called me Sam Black's vessel. And I think I might, you know, embroider that on a
that
shirt
well.
Or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're the one that brought the article to our attention. And I think brought it to the Cube World's attention. So credit where credit is due.
Thank you. I don't know. Like, do you think this will ever be a 3-3 in your format? And is a 2-mana 3-3 that only costs, you know, one color of mana as opposed to Watch Wolf or whatever, is that good enough?
I think given the additional risk of, like, you get into combat and they have a removal spell for another one of your creatures and now you just threw away your creature that you thought was a 3-3 but was actually a 2-2. No, I don't think it is. I think it's bad. I'll be honest. I think if I put it in there, it would be actively bad. There's so many times someone new has drafted my cube and been like, I didn't get to have a creature in play and I didn't expect that. Like, I had my Winota and I literally never had Winota and another creature in play at the same time, right? The nature of the Bun Magic Cube is there's so much removal running around. I value small games at so many points where I have to make decisions about what cards to include or exclude. I always value the small game option pretty much. So, yeah, I think this card just does not get there in the Bun Magic Cube. It might get there in your cube, but I do think overall people are that I've seen are overrating the power level of this card. And we have a hot take to that effect, too.
Here is my hot take for the bunny. Card is ass.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you. I think it will end up being a 3-3 or 4-4 on most of my format's boards. But, like, that's one piece of removal away from trading down in combat, which is not necessarily a good place to be. On the other hand, just to speak a little bit in the defense of an animal this cute.
It do be cute.
It's so cute. It might be the case that people will draft differently if this is in their deck. So, like, emphasizing Ancestral Blade, which I think you run, and Barbed Spike and so on.
Those Thraven are all regular Inspector. Cute cards for what it's worth. I don't run any of those.
Well, maybe this needs
I
to be
I do have Glimmer Lens. That's the closest I have to the same kind of card. And I have a 2-mana card that makes 2 game pieces on ETB.
Yeah, or Thraben Inspector. I think maybe that's a route for, you know, kind of buffing this thing's power. If you're a cube designer like me who feels compelled to run it because, again, it's cute, but aren't sure about the power level, that might be a way to kind of give it a boost.
The other thing I want to call out here is just that I've seen people comparing this to Tarmogoyf, and I consider myself I feel like I've become a connoisseur of Tarmogoyf in the past few years of playing it in my cube after ignoring it for a long time and thinking it was wrong for my environment and now feeling like it is so right and the thing that I always wanted and couldn't see. One of the great things about Tarmogoyf that has made it constructed all-star for a long time and relevant in the Bun Magic Cube and I'm sure other similar environments is how good it is on an empty board. One of the powers of Tarmogoyf is that it's 2-mana for a potentially game-ending threat that doesn't require anything else except that you've also just played other spells, right? This requires that things still be in play and is kind of the opposite, right? Like, if there's a, you know, attrition war where you're going back and forth one for one removal here and there, and you then have a Tarmogoyf that's like your one card that your opponent doesn't have an answer for, that's going to be a giant card that just takes over the game immediately. Whereas this is going to be a 1-1. It's going to be laughable. It's just going to be ignored. So if you do want to compare this to Tarmogoyf, just recognize that it plays totally differently. Like, completely different decks want this, right? Like, the reason Tarmogoyf is so good in Jund is because your deck is chock full of Lightning Bolts and Thought Seizes and other removal spells that just fill the graveyards and you can lean on your one little 2-mana card that can become a giant monster to finish the game. this is like a payoff for, this is like a, like to me, this card is very similar in power level to like Glorious Anthem. It's like, yeah, the potential is there. If you got a bunch of stuff, this could be really good. But how often is that really happening realistically in the cube that you're talking about? And that's what the thing, that's what I think people that are curious about this card should be asking themselves.
It is definitely the opposite of Tarmogoyf. What lives feeds the bun of corn. I mean, you are talking about a pretty sort of narrow environment, though. Like, if I put this in regular cube, this would be insane. Like,
it would not be insane. I disagree.
I think it would be nuts.
I think this is a new trope of spoiler season, is you thinking a card would be insane in the regular cube that I think would be totally fine.
That's maybe. But, I mean, I would say just from, like, a play pattern perspective, what I don't love about this is it just rewards you for being far ahead. And I'm always more interested in cards that allow you to catch up and create more dynamic back and forth. And this is just saying, hey, if you're already going wide, now you can also be going tall. And potentially that like means you can actually close out a game, but that's not necessarily a kind of play pattern I'm interested in.
All right. We've spoken on the bun of corn at length.
Next up, we're moving into Adventure Land now. So almost all the rest of the cards we're going to be talking about are adventures because they are, in fact, extremely popular.
It's adventure time.
Virtue of Persistence is the next card. This is a 7-mana enchantment. At the beginning of your upkeep, put a target creature card from a graveyard onto the battlefield under your control. Maybe more importantly, it also has the sorcery adventure, Lochthwain Scorn. For 1 and a black, target creature gets -3/-3 until end of turn, and you gain 2 life. So, looks like a big scary enchantment. Mostly it's a removal spell that draws you a big scary enchantment.
Okay, am I a Grinch for not wanting my players to do this?
No, you're not a Grinch. Like, you're a thoughtful cube designer, Parker.
I read this and I'm like, oh, that sounds like a terrible way to lose a game. I don't care if it's a 2-for-1 that, I don't know, it could cost 0 mana for the adventure and I'm still not into it because I don't want to lose a game to a very slow enchantment that I can see coming for 5 turns. Sounds terrible.
That is a really great point that I haven't seen other people bring up, that this might have the sort of Tetsamok issue of, you know, it's coming, and if you don't have a counterspell and you can't race it, it's not quite as bad because it's not necessarily punishing you for playing the game of Magic, but in some ways, yeah, like, you're skeptical about, do you want to be trading off creatures, or does it hurt that much more when your opponent is removing your creatures because you know that it's fueling the future Virtue of Persistence? I definitely see that point.
Although maybe, you know, maybe the counterplay is to just delve your own graveyard or, like, Scrabbling Claws yourself or whatever. Maybe it's not as bad as I fear, but for now, I'm not going to play it.
It's definitely going to depend on the environment, and I do think that that information is a real factor of this card, right? Everyone's talking, rightfully so, about how it's this relatively efficient removal spell, you know, maybe half a notch below the most efficient stuff, but still quite good, that then draws you this bomb. But your opponent will play differently, knowing that effectively one of the cards in your hand is this bomb they are aware of that does have a profound effect on the game if it ever comes down. I would not expect to resolve this against a blue deck. Well, I guess a lot of blue decks in my cube don't even have creatures, so they just let you do it and, you know, deal with it otherwise. But it is a factor of the card's evaluation for sure that this will be a known information that will be seen coming for a while.
Yeah, and this is being tested by about 26% of our respondents with a rating of only 6.2, so a little
kind
lower
of, a low rating, yeah,
of some of the other cards that are at this volume.
All right, our next adventure, the 5th most popular card from Wilds of Eldraine, is Questing Druid. Creature, human druid, it costs 1 and a green for a 1/1. Whenever you cast a spell that's white, blue, black, or red, put a counter on it. So it's like Quirion Dryad. But it also has an adventure. Seek the Beast is 1 and a red for an instant adventure. Exile the top 2 cards of your library. Until your next instep, you may play those cards. So, okay, this is obviously strictly better than Quirion Dryad. Fairly powerful. It can be a 2-for-1, and one of those cards is itself card advantage. But despite these really favorable rates, I think it's easy to, you know, kind of underestimate how much investment is required to really maximize this card's power. Not only do you have to splash green into your blue-red tempo deck or whatever, which is a real cost in Limited, where you will have to spend picks on the fixing lands and so on. Not only that, but like Quirion Dryad is really bad when a 1 and a red impulsive draw 2 is really good, and vice versa, right? So it's going to be really hard to get max value from both of halves of this card at the same time.
Say more about that. Why is Quirion Dryad fundamentally opposed to a impulsive draw two?
Well, let's say, you know, you cast this on turn eight or whatever, and you get to cast everything. So you cast the adventure on your opponent's turn, then you cast Quirion Dryad, or Questing Druid, and then you play the two cards that you exiled. Well, now you've got a 3-3 on turn eight, and your opponent plays Virtue of Persistence. And
it also drew you three cards.
Yeah, I mean,
it's also two mana maybe, draw three.
Maybe. But, like, I don't think the 1-1 is the best part of the draw.
Compare it to other green 2-drops, I think it's definitely one of the best things you could possibly do in that situation.
Maybe that's so.
I guess the reason I ask is I see these as actually kind of on the same axis, because impulsive draw, you want cheap spells. You want to be able to cast everything you draw off your impulsive draw, which is easier the more cheap spells you have, which I think is also the same of Quirion Dryad. You want cheap spells to grow the thing. Both these effects, I think, work well with cantrips, and so, like you said, I think Teemer is maybe the ideal home for this card, though I think it'll be perfectly fine in like a Gruul beatdown deck too. I think Quirion Dryad is just a fundamentally cool card. I love the old school decks that played Quirion Dryad, and that was like their win condition, and these like kind of controlling tempo decks, and the idea of a Quirion Dryad that might be good enough for the Bun Magic Cube is extremely appealing to me. I don't know if it actually is, though. The question for at least my cube is really going to come down to how good is Seek the Beast, the impulsive draw two, because a large amount of the time you're going to pay two mana for this thing and you're going to go to try and grow it, and as soon as it gets big enough to matter, it'll just get disfigured in response to one of the counters or something, and it'll be gone. So I don't have high hopes for the creature side being amazing, but I think the combination of these two could make a pretty potent package. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, let me just be clear. Like, I'm playing this card. I'm really excited about it, actually. And one of the reasons I like it so much is that it reads really powerfully. And so I think it'll get drafters excited. It might get them to build around this and draft differently than they would otherwise. But not in the same way that they draft differently for Oko. You know, like, this is not going to be a risk in my format in the same way that other cards that inspire different draft decisions might be a risk. And part of the reason it's less risky is that, you know, it's got this little bit of internal tension where you really want to cast your Druid before you cast your Seek the Beast cards, but that might make your sequencing harder to do or whatever. It's got this little bit of internal tension.
Question for you two. How interested would you be in playing this card in a deck with no green mana in either your cube, Parker, or the Bun Magic Cube? Just Seek the Beast in your straight-up blue-red deck or whatever. Mono-red.
Isn't that exactly already another card?
I mean, I think it's better.
Ren's Resolve, roughly.
The other cards are sorceries, so you have to spend the mana on the same turn. But a lot of them say you can play until your next turn.
Next turn, yeah.
So it's like kind of different. I think that is maybe one of the clear questions here. Is like, I don't think that's ever going to happen or very often going to happen, but I'm not sure that's correct. I think people are going to look at this card and say, oh, this is a green-red card. If I'm not playing green and red, I'm not going to play this card. And that's maybe one of my more abstract criticisms of the dual-colored adventure cards, is that I think, even though they're ostensibly split cards, you could just play them in either deck of just the mono color, I think drafters very infrequently will, right? I just don't think people are going to look at this card visually and, you know, if they're playing mono red, I think they're going to be pretty quick to just skip over this card in the pack because it doesn't look like a card for their deck.
Yeah, I mean, we just had Reckless Impulse in a recent set. That was a sorcery and was still, at least in limited, a pretty powerful card.
So yeah, I don't know. I think the card is interesting. I'm definitely going to play it. I think this is a card I can make room for before CubeCon, which is something I've changed my mind on since we last talked in our previous episode. Before, I was like, I don't know if I have space in this in the pre-CubeCon edits locked list, but I think I do. I'm going to put this in there, I'm pretty sure. All right, on to our top four. Fourth most popular card in this set is Elusive Otter. This is also a dual-colored adventure card. The creature side is a blue mana for a 1-1 with prowess, and creatures with power less than Elusive Otter's power can't block it. So a combination of prowess and a skulk-like evasion. And then the sorcery side is X and a green for a sorcery that distributes X +1/+1 counters among any number of creatures you control.
I'm sorry to be like this, but it's actually the opposite of skulk.
Right. Okay, so only big stuff can block it. That actually makes a little more sense then. So it's you do want to grow it first main phase if you can, because it just makes it unable to be chumped, essentially.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Which is nice, yeah.
Hey, Parker, don't be sorry to correct me, because that's just 50 less comments we get.
Tweets? Okay,
the
good.
Day that episode comes out. So please, by all means, correct all things. What do you think of his otter, though, Parker?
Well, I really like it. And actually, I remember Anthony saying last week, well, last week my time, not our listeners, but saying on the first episode that this might be too good for the regular cube. And I really doubt it. And I think this is a perfect regular card. And I also think it'll scale fairly well into more high-powered cubes like the Bun Magic cube or my Ship of Theseus cube. Kind of the same story as Questing Druid. I think the fact that this needs to be green in order to maximize its power is a kind of knock to power level, especially in a drafted environment, because it comes with a little more risk, a little more necessary investment to maximize the card's power, but it really pays you off in a cool, novel way. So yeah, I really like it. Plus, it's cute.
It is a cute little otter. I'm a little bit surprised just to see it this high. It's also a pretty significant jump up in terms of the number of testers, almost 30%, whereas most of the previous ones we've been talking about are hovering around just 20. But I guess it's kind of a cool card. We'll see.
People like otters. This is objectively true.
That's a good point, yeah.
From my observations throughout the cube community, it seems like people just really love otters. And that's a pretty good way to make a card a little more appealing. Just slap an otter type line on it.
I'm also going to call a shot that the Bloomborough set, the one that's reportedly got no humans in it, I think it's going to have otter creature type matters and also maybe some mice and rats to synergize with some of the cards that are being seeded in this set. That's my prediction.
Called shot here on Lucky Paper Radio. There is one other potential hiccup to the play pattern of this card that I think we should call out, which is that if you cast the adventure side of any of these cards and that spell doesn't resolve because it was fizzled, in the case of Grove's Bounty, let's say you go to put 3+1/+1 counters on one creature and they remove it, you then don't get to cast the otter. The spell is countered. Your otter does not go on an adventure. This comes up quite a bit in the Bun Magic Cube with a lot of the adventure cards I run currently, where people will kill their own creature to make it so you don't get to put your Bonecrusher Giant on adventure, or you go to Rimrock Knight something and they kill it and now you don't have the Rimrock Knight to cast off of the adventure. I think a non-zero amount of the time, even if you have blue-green in your deck, you just won't want to risk not playing the otter to tap out into potential removal on Grove's Bounty. It is nice that if you have three creatures, right, you can probably pretty safely rely on your opponent not removing three creatures in instant speed. And if they could do that, were you ever winning that game anyway? But if you only have one creature and you're looking to get max value out of this card, it's going to be risky because you are, you know, if that spell gets countered, you're not going to draw the card, you're not going to draw the otter.
That is a funny quirk about distributing, where if you do name just one target and it gets removed, the whole spell is fizzled. Where if you're just like, well, I'll put three counters on this creature and then just one over here just to be safe, you might be able to protect it.
And just to be clear, you don't have to choose the numbers till the spell resolves. So you choose the target creatures.
No, you choose when you're choosing how to distribute things. It is all part of choosing the modes for the spell.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I'm pretty confident.
I never would have figured that out from looking at the rules text of this card, but
otherwise, you would just say, oh, I'll name all of my creatures, and then your opponent would say, I don't lightning bolt any of them because I don't know which one you're going to make big.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. And it would not make any sense to be able to name more targets than there are counters you're going to be distributing. So, big brain, Anthony. You're
Magic
a very smart man.
Rules.
I just still can't get excited about this otter. I don't know why. It doesn't spark joy for me. I think it's a great fit, as you said, Parker. I don't know. I'm not feeling it. I can't explain why.
Is it eluding you?
Yes, it is.
All right, let's take a brief break from Adventure Time and talk about Sir Ginger the Meal Ender. This is 2 generic mana for a legendary artifact, creature, food, knight. It's a 3-1. It has trample, hexproof, and haste as long as your opponent controls a planeswalker. Whenever another artifact you control is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, put a 1-1 counter on it and scry 1. And it also has the food ability of pay 2 and tap and sacrifice it to gain life equal to its power. I'm a little surprised to see this so high up here.
33% of our testers apparently also have a turbo cube.
I mean, yeah, it fits right in the turbo cube. I guess it being kind of like an anti-planeswalker card is maybe something people are interested in. It also plays in like similar spaces like Arcbound Ravager. Maybe it just being like a really, really cool, powerful payoff for artifact matters is what's putting it this high. What do you think?
I don't know what's putting it this high. There definitely was a period of my cube design journey where a card that read as a like 2-mana card that is really good against planeswalkers would have been really appealing to me, especially a colorless one. I don't know how much better this is against Planeswalkers. I mean, the trample is relevant, but like, this is still going to trade with something. It's still got one toughness. Nothing, none of the abilities it gains from your opponent having a Planeswalker make it any safer in combat. So,
I mean, it has the ability to get pretty large if you have a couple treasures or
in the late game. Yeah, it does. It's true. I think maybe it's just a bunch of little things that are all adding up, right? I think some people probably like this as just another reasonably aggressive colorless card, which I know a lot of cube designers are drawn to because it allows them to support aggressive decks without having to dedicate big portions of colored sections of their cube to redundant cheap threats. Maybe it's in there for a lot of people that just like the artifact synergies, like you said. I think the card's kind of fun and flavorful. Maybe you're into that.
I think it's the whole enchilada, right? Like, maybe it's
a little bit of the cookie.
Oh my goodness.
I'm sorry. I feel bad about that.
I'm shook. Some people want to hate on Planeswalkers in a very explicit way. Some people are really interested in the quasi Arcbound Ravager text. Some people are really interested in a colorless Blade of the Sixth Pride. And I think it's notable that all of this is unified with a cool legendary creature that actually has a really neat story. Do you know the story of Seer Ginger?
Absolutely not.
I remember from the original Eldraine trailer that Garrick, kind of on a whim, ate another gingerbread cookie, which maybe she's coming back wrathfully.
Yes, exactly it. Seer Ginger, her partner, was eaten by Garrick as a snack, and now apparently she's vowed revenge and is riding a gingerbread horse and wielding a fork to have her revenge on Garrick. That's just awesome, right?
And kind of a gruesome moment from that trailer. I'm spooky. Not remembering it. It kind of reminds me. I just rewatched the old Jackie Chan classic Rumble in the Bronx, which is a great, fun action movie I can highly recommend to anybody out there that wants to watch it. Though there's a scene in there where they straight up murder a man by putting him into a wood chipper, and then his friend brings the guy's wood chipped body parts back to the gang's hangout in trash bags. And it's like very dark and it's kind of
played. What's the connection here exactly?
I don't have to explain. I'm not going to explain the narrative of it. Watch Rumble in the Bronx if you're interested, but it definitely was like a very, it's kind of played for laughs, but then you really think about what's happening, and you're like, that's very dark. And the kind of similar story here with Seer Ginger, whose partner was brutally murdered and eaten alive, and now it's just a fun cute cookie card for us to play with.
I appreciate the wordplay and the card name as well.
Yes, the wordplay is good.
I also want to point out that this is far from the only flavorfully kind of resonant and evocative design in this file.
Oh yeah,
the whole set is just full of these designs where the name of the card is explained and kind of like reinforced by the rules text of the card. And that's, it was true for Lord of the Rings too, but not everybody is, intimately familiar with those books. But everybody knows Grimm's Fairy Tales, or a lot of people. So yeah, just really wonderful blend of flavor and mechanic in this set. And that's actually also a feature of our next card, the second most popular card from Wilds of Eldraine. This is Mosswood Dreadknight. 1 and a green for a creature human knight, 3/2 trample. When it dies, you may cast it from your graveyard as an adventure until the end of your next turn. And its adventure is Dread Whispers, 1 and a black for a sorcery. You draw a card and you lose 1 life. This is tested by 40% of our respondents with an average rating of 7.5. This is the most highly rated card from among the ones we've talked about. And do you know the story this is referencing? This is Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. One of Arthur's knights is, dining at the round table or whatever. And then this guy comes in and he's like, hey, wouldn't it be fun to have a little contest? You behead me, and if I survive, I get to behead you in 1 year's time. Won't that be fun? And Sir Gawain is like, yeah, sure, let's do it. This can't possibly go wrong
for me.
Wait,
what did Sir Gawain stand to gain?
Yeah, that's the messed up part about this story.
I have no idea. But this guy does not die, as you might have guessed. And the Green Knight is just like, okay, Gawain, see you in a year. And Gawain just has to sweat for a year, and then at the end, the knight just like nicks him on the neck because he showed a little bit of cowardice, and then is otherwise like, well, you did a great job. Now go back to the round table and you can all wear a green sash in honor of my memory or whatever.
Very normal stories.
just really
love a very normal
stuff.
Fairy tale.
I don't know if the ending is very satisfying there.
There's a movie a couple years ago that it's kind of like watching a 2-hour painting. Really beautiful movie, but extremely bizarre.
How long is a normal painting?
10 seconds or so.
Okay.
I appreciate the genuine answer.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a Cezanne still life, then for me, it's like maybe 15 minutes. But all that to say, this is also kind of a union of flavor and mechanic. You know, you kill the knight once and then it goes on the adventure and kind of whispers in Sir Gawain's ear and then comes back because it doesn't get beheaded very easily. It's also pretty powerful, pretty transparently powerful. And that's, I don't even need to talk about that. So that's why I'm talking about the flavor. But
I will say something about the power level of this card, which is that it seems like it's tilted a little differently on this one than other adventures. Like Dread Whispers,
oh, yeah.
Not that good. So many of the other adventures we've said that like it as a baseline is already competitively costed, right? I mean, just look at Seek the Beast, right? That compares to a relatively good card we've had in recent sets almost exactly. Plus it says draw a card on it, right? This one doesn't. 2 mana to draw a card and lose a life is pretty below rate.
But you also draw the Dread Knight,
well,
so
yes.
Kind of like Sign and Blood.
Well, but that's my point, is that you have to factor in the advantage for it to actually compare it to a regular card, whereas the other ones do before you even added the fact
sure,
that you're drawing
okay.
an additional card. So I think that it's interesting. The adventure here seems like the much worse side of this card, and the other side is just, you know, a 2-mana 3-2 trample with upside, which is, I think, pretty darn pushed compared to Quirion Dryad, which is not at all pushed by modern standards, right? So to me, it feels like a lot of the cards are tilted like the adventure's kind of nutty and the creature is a little bit less good because you can't draw a great creature off of a nutty adventure. And here, it's tilted differently because you're always going to draw this good creature because the creature side's quite powerful, and so to balance it out, the adventure side is pretty lackluster. And the fact that you can obviously do them all an indefinite number of times certainly factors
yeah.
into how they were balanced, I'm sure.
I was wondering, when you're doing your how many rectangles does this card generate chart, this is infinite rectangles, right?
Yeah, if I was doing my game size calculator.
I guess you actually do have an infinite checkbox.
I absolutely do.
Perfect.
I think it's the kind of thing where I'm probably most likely to play the creature first, start beating down.
Heck
and
yeah.
getting really reckless with this thing because it has trample and also because once it dies, I'm just like, yeah, I'll keep profiting. I'll pay a 2-mana installment plan, draw a card, and then later it's going to come back. Just does not get beheaded.
Yeah, this thing is not going to be fun to block. You're not going to feel good blocking this.
Mm-mm. It's so cool.
It's really cool. Love the card. Love the showcase treatment. And that brings us to our number one card from Wilds of Eldraine, which is Cheeky House Mouse. 1 white mana for a white 2/1 creature mouse. And the adventure attached to it is also white. This is not one of the dual-colored ones. It's the uncommon monocolored adventure creature from white. And it is Squeak By, which is a sorcery that says target creature you control gets +1/+1 till end of turn. It can't be blocked by creatures with power 3 or greater this turn. So we see another white 2/1 with upside. The upside being this pump spell that gives a little bit of evasion for a turn. Only being tested by 42% of our respondents, so 41.3% of our respondents with a rating of 6.9. I can't help but think back to call time. How many people were testing Usher of the Fallen? Like 80% of our respondents?
It was a lot.
So again, this is another data point to me showing that the people's attitude towards cube design and what cards ought to or should be or they desire to include has definitely changed, because we've already seen tons of evidence that people love adventures. So it's not like people are saying, well, I would play this, but it's got an adventure attached to it. People seem to love that mechanic overall. I think it's substantially better than Usher of the Fallen in terms of power level, but not in a way that I don't think people are looking at this and saying this is too good for my cube. I don't think that's a danger for most people. So it's just showing me that we've gotten to a point where only 42%, 41% of the people at least responding to our surveys, which is obviously a selective bias, are necessarily interested in playing the new white 2/1 with upside that's floating around.
I think it's also very fun to say Cheeky House Mouse.
Great card name.
Squeak By.
Great card name.
It's so good.
It's really fun. I also really enjoy it. It's true.
A great story here, too. I mean, this isn't maybe a well known fairy tale like some of the others, but like, yeah, it's an unlikely hero. You know, your mouse is squeaking by the witch, and that's just so cool. Also really funny to like make your Savannah lions squeak by.
It's got to be said. A lot of flavor in terms of power and toughness, I think, is a little bit off in this set. Obviously, now we see that a mouse is exactly the same size as a lion. That's maybe a little problematic. I am less bothered by that than I am by the fact that in this set, there are both rat and mouse tokens. They're both 1/1s. Rats are bigger than mice. We all know this. And the rats are objectively worse. They can't block. So the rat is just a less powerful creature than the mouse token in this set. What the heck?
Checks out.
No, it doesn't check out. The opposite of checks out. It makes no sense. Flavor judge ruling.
No, I mean, those are all flavorful decisions, and I think in this case I support it. You know, sometimes we are not so happy with the sort of proliferation of lots and lots of different types of tokens, but sometimes I think that it would really be a big flavor fail for them just to be like, yep, every 1/1 is just a, what is the most generic white 1/1 token? A soldier?
I have one more. Actually, pretty substantial complaint about this card, and I can't understand why they did this. Not every adventure card is available in the showcase frame, and Cheeky House Mouse is among them that is not available. I guess they just had so many adventures in this set, they didn't want to commission that much extra art.
Yeah, I think it's all the commons and uncommons that they are not, and a number of people actually mentioned in the survey that that was the thing they were disappointed about
in
the
set. It's really disappointing.
They have a Pauper Cube, and that was one of their favorite things that Wizards has done in a while, because it let them get some like fancy frames and stuff, which usually you don't get at common and uncommon, but the line that I heard was that people felt it made the frame less exciting, so they wanted to keep it only to higher rarities, but
ew.
You don't get to use that argument when you have been
I'm just printing saying that's what
everything
I heard.
Into the ground. You reprints of everything with 900 different printings. You don't get to use the, well, it's not special anymore if we print too many of it. That's all you've been doing for
that,
3 years.
They found the line.
Printing
they
too
found
many
the line.
Of
it's
it.
Right here.
Okay. I think it has to be a cost thing. You know, I mean, they pay a lot of money for each piece of art they commission, and if you had another 30 adventures at common and uncommon that you're going to have to pay for custom art for, I can see that being a significant barrier. But definitely disappointing on this card in particular, which I know a lot of people, obviously, the most popular card amongst Cuban designers we surveyed, and none of them get to play the nice-looking showcase version because it doesn't exist. Maybe we'll get a promo of it. That would be sick.
I'm sure there will be proxies made of this, right?
Oh, yes. I'm certain it already exists. Not that, you know.
Yeah.
Check to see what fell off of the truck in your town. Hello. It's Andy from the editing booth. A different editing booth. 1 week after the previous editing booth. Because I've since been to LA. This is right the night before this podcast drops. And like we mentioned in the episode, we recorded it a little bit early because of this travel. And so we've got a couple of hot takes that have come in since I finished editing. And I still want to put them in the episode. But because the edit's already done, it's really annoying to go back and add them in the middle. So I'm plopping them here at the end. I apologize for that. But enjoy the community hot takes nonetheless.
My hot take is for the card Tempest Heart. I think that Scan the Clouds is easily among the best 2-mana blue cantrips we've ever gotten. It might not look as exciting as the other off-color adventures in this set, but it plays fantastically. It's probably better than Faithless Looting in lower-powered fair environments. If you care enough about a density of cantrips in your environment to dip into basically any 2-mana blue cantrips, give Tempest Heart another look. That includes you, curators who are still cubing Charter Course in 2023.
Avalanche Master here. Have you ever wanted your Chloris God of Destiny, your Descent into Avernus, maybe even your Orcish Bowmasters to be drawing cards in addition to dealing damage to the face of your opponent? Well, with Virtue of Courage, this is more than possible. Now, a lot of people seem to be evaluating this card as the sum of its parts, but it is more than the sum of its parts. On one hand, you have a 2-mana value shock that is, of course, by itself, by no means a great card. On the other hand, you have an enchantment that is also quite unplayable if it was just the enchantment. But the ability to kill off an early blocker or just deal damage to the face of your opponent in the late game, and then once you run out of gas and you establish board presence with those repeatable damage outputs such as Green Lavamancer, such as Sulfuric Vortex, such as Chandra Torches of Defiance, and start drawing cards from the damage you're dealing, this is something that a lot of cubes that support Threat Prism decks will benefit from. Now, I admit, this is by no means a card for all of the cubes out there, But I also feel that a lot of people don't realize that there are a lot of cubes that have these game pieces. Their cubes have these game pieces. And they've kind of slept over Virtue of Courage, which the card does not deserve. It is a fantastic card. It's by no means an S-tier card, but it is a card that will lead to memorable game moments, and I highly, highly recommend you try it out. Avalanche Master here with a second hot take for the Wilds of Eldraine. On Etherhub, there is a fantastic article regarding which number is it best to choose with Talion, the Kindly Lord. Now, the article is talking about Modern, it's talking about competitive EDH, but what's said in the article is also quite applicable to power-motivated cubes. If you have a power-motivated environment, if you have a power-motivated cube, chances are the average mana value of cards in your cube is somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5, maybe 3. Choosing 1 or 2, as the article suggests, would be the best play in your cube and would lead to Talion playing a lot like Shieldred. Now, this is no Shieldred, of course, but if you feel that Shieldred is a bit too powerful for your cube, maybe Talion is an interesting inclusion that you can consider. Another thing that's quite interesting about Talion is the minigame the card provides. I am a huge fan of cards that introduce such elements to the game, and I can't recommend testing Talion enough. On top of that, the ability to put a flyer on the battlefield that draws you a card whenever your opponent tries to find an answer for it is something that's also people seem to be underappreciating for Talion. I highly recommend checking the card, and I think this is the top pick for me from Wilds of Eldraine, and the card I expect to stay the longest time in my cube.
Thus concludes our conversation on Wilds of Eldraine. Should we talk about any of the commander cards? I think there's that one sort of standout. Well, not even really. I don't think it's worth talking about it.
No.
No, we're not even talking about it.
People are less high on Monarch cards than they used to be, I believe. Which
good. Good job, everybody. Yeah. Everybody, you did a growth. Good job. We're very proud of you.
Yeah.
All right. Any closing thoughts on Wilds of Eldraine, boys?
I'm just, grateful that 4 years after the first Eldraine, we're here for the second one, and we've got many times more respondents than that first survey. And so I'm grateful that people are still reading these articles that, Jet began with y'all, and I'm excited for the next series of them.
Well said. I'm also glad to still be here. It's funny, I feel like our reach for the surveys definitely has plateaued, right? There's only a certain number of cube designers out there that are aware of us and willing to do the fairly intensive task of like filling out a survey for a new set. There's also a lot of cube designers that just don't update their cubes that regularly, and so they wouldn't have updated it by the time that we are closing the survey. But it's funny that is kind of plateaued for... It feels like it's kind of plateaued for almost a couple years now. But in other regards, the show just continues to grow. The podcast continues to grow more popular, but we're not finding more people that are willing to fill out surveys. We're just finding people that hopefully are less invested in Cube, and maybe we can be the entry point for them.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, on that note, if you haven't updated your Cube, and maybe you're listening to this after we've closed the survey, in 3 years, we'll write a retrospective on this at the time that it rotates from Standard, and you'll get to see another look at how this set has fared in Cube. We're not writing one this September because there's no Standard rotation. They've changed the rules, but
very
next
thoughtful
September,
of Wizards to think about us and all the work we're doing and not to put too much on our plates by making Standard longer. I appreciate that.
Next September, we'll have an extra long Standard rotation article.
Well, that's it for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. Thank you all for tuning in. All of the music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This show is produced by Anthony, Parker, and I, thinking really hard about magic cards, making some graphs about it, writing some JavaScript, and then speaking into microphones about it. Parker and Anthony, thank you for joining me on this Sunday evening.
Thanks for having us.
Nope. Looks like we just got survey response 299, so perhaps we'll get 300 by the time we hit end record.
Woo! I'm just about to hit end record. It's right around the corner.
Let's see.
Adventure time, come on, cast your friends, send them off to distant lands with Cheeky Mouse and Kellen. The fun will never end unless you're mana screwed.